Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place we are in the know. You can find us on the internet on commonwealthclub.org. I'm Bernard Osher, your chair for today. The program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series and is presented in association with the San Francisco Film Society. The program today will feature legendary Hollywood producer Jerry Weintraub in conversation with Mary Bitterman, chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. Before turning the program over to Mary, I'd like to say a few words about my longtime friend Jerry Weintraub. It's hard to believe that we've known each other for almost 50 years. We met in Maine. I was in the hardware business in Biddeford, and Jerry was vacationing in Kennebunkport. It's been a long and rewarding relationship, with one major exception. He never put me in any of his movies. I went on location when Jerry was making The Karate Kid. I drove there, it took me several hours to get there, and I hung around waiting. Perhaps he was going to give me a little bit of a cameo part in this movie, but it wasn't to be. A few years later, I went to London, where Jerry was doing The Avengers with Sean Connery, Ralph Fiennes, and Uma Thurman. I stayed there for 2 days, and again, nothing happened. But the most importantly, I went to Rome, and he was producing that time, making the pictures, Ocean's 13. You can imagine what a great cast. Catherine Zeta-Jones, Julia Roberts, George Clooney, and I stayed there 2 days, and guess what? Nothing happened. Anyhow, in spite of all this, that was my quest for stardom. It just didn't happen. But in spite of that, Jerry has been such a mensch, such a real major person in raising money for various charities in Los Angeles and various other places. This last December, he got the UNICEF Humanitarian Award. I did play a major part, though, in something very important in Jerry's career. I went to New York, and Jerry was living on 54th Street at the time, and I was visiting with him. And he says, come with me. I'm going down to the Greenwich Village. I'm going to go to a club. The name of the club was the Village Gate. I remember it very well. And the two of us went in there, and we sat there. We were going to preview this entertainer. And he came in, and he sat there on a stool, and he started playing his guitar, you know, and singing songs back and forth, all like that. And then finally he finished, and he came over, and he sat down, and started talking with Jerry and so on. And then we left, and we went outside of the club. And Jerry said to me, he says, what do you think of Barney? I said, geez, Jerry, he just doesn't do anything for me. And Jerry looked at me sort of quizzically, and I know what went through his mind. He said, what am I asking this guy his opinion about this guy? He's in the hardware business. What the hell does he know about show business? And so he says, you know, you're wrong. He says, this guy is going to be great, and I'm going to be his manager. Guess who? Johnny Denver. That's a true story. Please welcome Jerry Weintraub's conversation with Mary Bitterman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bernard Osher. You know, and Jerry's encouraged me to call him Jerry, so I don't want you to think that this is being, you know, moving in the direction of too much informality. But, you know, I want to ask you a fairly delicate question. But I know, having been born in Brooklyn, my husband was born in Brooklyn, Brooklyn boys are pretty candid, outspoken. You know, you have such an ability to recognize talent. I mean, just over and over again, proven ability. When will you put Bernard in a film? Have you thought about it? Are you thinking you've been working on something that would just be right?
No, I really haven't thought about it. And I don't think I will. But I actually should do his life story. It's so, excuse me, his life story is so great, and he's such a great man, a man who I admire so much, that I wouldn't put him in a film because it would just destroy his
his image.
Myth. You know, he wanted to do a scene with Julia Roberts. That's what was it. He insisted on that. It wasn't as if I could get him to work with Matt Damon. Or so. He said, I want to work with that lady, Julia Roberts, or Catherine Zeta-Jones. So I said, no, Bonnie, let's keep this for a while. We'll just keep it on the side for a while. But he could be in any film that I do anytime.
Okay, well, the wonderful. Next one, I think he's ready.
I'm doing the life story of Liberace next, and he is definitely
Do you know what, Jerry?
I think he's definitely ready.
You know, Bernard Osher, at the age of 80, started piano lessons. He's very serious about his piano. If you give him a little more time, he might be quite promising.
I came up for his 80th birthday, and Placido Domingo sang, and I didn't hear Placido Domingo ask Bonnie to play the piano while he sang. So that's another strike, you know.
But he didn't start lessons until the following day. But
I see.
He's made
that's
a lot
why.
Of progress.
Maybe on his 85th we can.
You know, I hope that all of you have a chance to read Jerry Weintraub's memoir. It's just absolutely incredible and covers such an array of personalities and really covers your development as a person and a persona.
Thank you.
You know, I think in this day and age, and in every day and age, people are looking for what are the ingredients for a successful and purposeful life. And it seems to me that you pay such respect to your parents. And I wondered if you'd just say a word about them. I think I told you on the phone that my favorite part of the book, I thought it was so special. After your mother is spending the day with Cary Grant at the horse races, and the next day Frank Sinatra shows up to visit with her and says, Mrs. Weintraub, what did you think about your, you know, friend that you were with yesterday? And about Cary Grant, she said, I think he's a wonderful man, but I prefer my Sammy. So I wondered if you would say a word about Rose and Sammy.
Sure, I will. I love talking about. I'd prefer talking about my mother and father than Sinatra or Jimmy Stewart or Gene.
Well, that's
Kelly
what I thought. I know those questions will come up, but I thought we should start with Rose
yeah.
and Sam.
Well, my dad and mom were born in America, and my mother came from Brooklyn. She was very cloistered. My dad traveled from the time he was 14 years old. He was a jewelry salesman, and he was a great guy, and my mom was a great woman. And in those days, I'm 72 now, in those days when I was a boy, he came home from school in New York, and everybody's door was open. Every mother was at the house. They had milk and cookies for you, and you didn't have to lock the doors, and everybody in the building knew everybody in the building, and you played outside with the same kids. It had a very warm, familial atmosphere that I don't see today. You know, you don't see that anywhere today, anywhere in the world. So it was a different time, and they gave me a tremendous amount of love and understanding. People always ask me, if you could have changed anything with your father and mother, what would it have been? And I said, well, if they would have owned an oil well or a brewery, it would have been nice. But the fact is that they didn't have to do that because my father taught me about business, and my mother gave me all the love and understanding that any mother could ever give a child. And I missed them terribly. I lost them both. My dad died, I think, 10 or 11 or 12 years ago, and my mom...
And very shortly after your mother.
Eight weeks. 8 weeks. And he told me, and he wasn't sick. And in fact, I was in Maine with Barney, and I went out, and my mom had Alzheimer's. Terrible, terrible disease. Horrible, horrible thing. And she was... We couldn't communicate with her for about 3 years. And my dad went to see her every day and had lunch with her and held her hand. And they were very much in love. They walked down the street together every day. They were totally in love with each other. And they were one person. They weren't two people. They were one person. And when my mother got sick, my father, it was a crushing blow to my father. And my father said to me, when she dies, I'm not going to be around long. And I said, well, don't talk like that. You're a healthy guy. And I said, you're still drinking three scotches every night before dinner. I know you'll be around. And he said, no, I don't think so. And he said, I can't think about life without her. And she passed away, and I was up in Maine, and I got a phone call from my brother, and he said, Dad wants to talk to you. And my father got on the phone. He was very healthy. And he said, I'd like to see you. Drive down to New York. And I said, well, I just got a new car, and it had that OnStar. It was the first year they had OnStar. And I got in the car and with my wife, and we left Kennebunkport, and we came down to New York City, and we got lost on the way. When we got down to New York, we went on the wrong highway, and we went past my public school, and we went to the building that I was born in by mistake. And all the while, my phone was ringing, and my brother was telling me that my dad wasn't feeling well, and he wanted to go into the hospital. And I said, what's wrong with him? Well, there's nothing wrong with him, but he says he wants to go in the hospital, and can you please call Mount Sinai Hospital? That's my concierge life.
Yeah.
Will you please call
you about that later.
will you please call Mount Sinai Hospital and make sure he gets a room facing the Central Park. He wants to look out at the park. And I said, sure. And we stopped at the building I was born in. It was just, I don't know, God again. I'm very spiritual and I believe in God. So he sent us there. When I got down to the hospital, my dad was already in a room, and he was fine. The doctors told me there was nothing wrong with him. He called for my brother and myself. We went in the room. He asked us to hug him. We gave him a hug. And he said, this is very hard for me. It's in the book, as you know, but it's hard for me to talk about. But he said, I love you very much. You've been great son. And he said the same to my brother. Give me a hug and a kiss. I said, are you okay, Dad? I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. And we walked out of the room, and he laid his head down and died. With no pain, no tubes, no doctors screaming, and nobody had to pull any plugs. He just went to sleep because he wanted to go see my mother. So,
I know. I thought that was, there's so much of the book that deals with the Hollywood characters who are all very interesting individuals. But I think what's so wonderful about the book is these very heartfelt things that I think really do, as Bernard said, make you a mensch. Just say a word about your brother, Melvin. And I love the fact that you noted that your mother chose the spelling of his name to be the same way that Melvin Douglas spelled Melvin.
Yeah,
I thought that was so sweet.
She loved Melvin Douglas. She loved the movies. My mother was afraid to go out and see the world, and she didn't want to travel. She never lived above the second floor, and if she lived on the second floor, it had to be something underneath that. She didn't want to go any higher. Third and the fourth floor were a little too high. And she named him Melvin Douglas because she loved Melvin Douglas in the movies. And she went to the movies all the time. I think that's one of the reasons I was interested in movies and entertainment. She read to me. She was a voracious reader. She read to me every night. She read books to me all the time, day and night. And she took me to movies. She went to Ingmar Bergman movies before anybody knew who Ingmar Bergman was. That was her way of seeing the world. She didn't want to travel. She didn't want to get on airplanes. She didn't want to go anywhere. But she did. She eventually did, in order to keep my brother and I adventurous, and she went with us. She went up Pike's Peak, which was unbelievable for her, and she went in airplanes. When I was in the service, she got on a plane and came to see me just to have lunch with me, and then went back. And in those days, I was in Nebraska. It was not done, you know. So it was they were great people, and I miss them a lot, but I, you know, it's just part of the journey. And I've learned that. I learned it this year because I was very ill this year. And I was always afraid of death. This is not in the book because the book was pretty well finished before I got sick. But I was always afraid of death until this year, and I had a near-death experience. And when it happened, I saw that light that everybody talks about. And maybe it was from power of suggestion all my life hearing about that light. But I saw that light, and it was very calming, and I wasn't afraid. And I'm not afraid anymore, which is good, a good thing. It's good not to be afraid because it's just part of life for me now. And I miss him anyway.
Yeah.
And I'll see him again.
Of course, of course. There's so many interesting characters in your book, and I know that people will have questions that'll come forward about everyone from Elvis Presley to Frank Sinatra to Cary Grant to John Denver and the rest. But what I also find truly fascinating are the characters that are in your book, such as the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush, Armand Hammer, and Rabbi Schneerson.
Yes.
You know, reading about this gentleman in New York who headed the Lubavitcher movement in Judaism, who a number of people thought was the Messiah. So as one is reading this memoir of Jerry Weintraub, you're introduced to this extraordinary, it's almost like Chaucer's tales. It's quite incredible.
It took me a long time to learn who Chaucer was, you know. But it is like I produced Canterbury Tales on Broadway without knowing who Chaucer was.
You see, there is something else that's just a true ingredient besides this heart and soul, which I've tried to reveal at the beginning of this conversation. There's chutzpah.
A lot of chutzpah.
But say something about one of these characters.
I'd be happy to.
Armand Hammer. I mean, where you're sitting in the front row at Brezhnev's funeral while our vice president, George H.W. Bush, is in the back with our dear San Francisco Bay Area friend, George Schultz.
Schultz, yes. And George and Barbara Schultz. Yes, and George and Barbara Bush. I was on a plane trip with Armand Hammer, and we were headed for...
Why don't you just say a word about Armand Hammer in case there's anyone who thinks of it only as baking soda?
Well, I don't think he had anything to do with the soap.
I know, that's
but he took,
so
he
incredible.
Took the baking powder. But he took credit for it anyway. But he was an industrialist, a philanthropist, art collector, fascinating man. Great salesman who learned at a very young age if you wanted to do business around the world, the best way to do it was to do it with the leader of a country. And somehow he put himself in that space. And wherever we went, wherever we traveled, we were greeted as dignitaries because of him, not because of me, because of him. And we were on a trip. I don't remember where we were going. We were on a trip, and we found out that Brezhnev died. We were going to China, maybe China. And we had a business together. Armin and I had a film production company that he wanted to form, basically to make films about himself, so that we could document the fact that he was wonderful. So we traveled the world together, but we became very, very, very close friends, and we did a lot of things in Russia, a lot of things in China, a lot of things all over the world, and he opened up a whole world to me that I probably wouldn't have seen, and as President Bush did, which I'll get to in
good,
a minute.
Good,
but Armand was an interesting, fascinating guy, and we got this phone call on the plane that Brezhnev had died. And he said to the pilots, turn the plane around, we've got to go to the funeral. And I said, I don't want to go to Brezhnev's funeral. I said, I don't care that Brezhnev died. You know, he was an anti-Semite, and he was the crazy guy. And I have nothing to do with Brezhnev. I don't want to go there. And he said, no, we have to go. That's where the action is. He always said that. So we turned the plane around, and we went to Moscow. And on the way to Moscow, in those days, it was completely communist, you know, the Iron Curtain was down.
Sure.
We were met in Paris or London. We always had to stop in London or Paris. And the Russians used to send two pilots to go in to take over the plane and fly it into Moscow because they didn't want us taking pictures of the missile sites if they had any. In those days, I always felt... I told George Bush in those days when he was vice president, I said, I don't know why you're so worried about the USSR and having a war with them, because if they ever shoot off a missile, it's going to go up and come right back down. That's how things worked in those days in Russia. Anyway, we got to Moscow, when we landed, we saw the vice president's plane. And the Secretary of State's plane, and the hospital plane. In those days, when any of our dignitaries went to Russia or China, they traveled with a complete plane that was a hospital with doctors and nurses in case anything happened to them, they wouldn't permit them to go to one of the hospitals in these countries. So we saw that sitting on the runway, and there were no private planes except Armin's plane, which went up. And we got there, and he said, well, I don't have a ticket for you for the funeral. I said, don't worry about it. I'll do without the ticket for the funeral.
You'll suffer.
When we got to, I had an apartment there in those days because we were doing a lot of business in Russia. And my phone rang, and it was the vice president at the time, subsequently the president, but he was vice president
George H.W. Bush.
Yes, at the time. And he called me and he said, Jerry, what are you doing? I heard you were here. What are you doing in Moscow? I said, I'm here for the funeral, but I'm not going to the funeral. He said, well, I don't understand that. I said, I'm here with Armin Hammer. He said, well, I'd love to have you at the funeral, but I only have 5 tickets and they won't give us any more because they don't want us seen in the Eastern Bloc countries on television. So they're kind of hiding us in the back. And... He said, but meet me at the embassy after the funeral, and we'll have lunch. I said, great, I'll meet you at the embassy. After I hung the phone up, I got a call from Armin, who said, I've got a ticket for you for the funeral. I said, oh, my God, now I have to go to this funeral. So I got dressed, and it was a terribly ugly day in Moscow, and in those days everything was gray. There was no color. Nobody wore a yellow tie. Nobody wore a blue shirt. There was no color. It was just gray. Everything was gray, and it was just the weather was awful, and the Kremlin was surrounded by guns and tanks and army people, and it was scary. It was frightening, We got to the, he came and picked me up in a Chirka. Chirka is like a limousine in Russia. And Russian-made, I guess it's the Russian-made Cadillac limousine or stretch, whatever you call it. And we got into the thing. We went over to the Kremlin. We got out of the car. He handed me the ticket. We went past a bunch of soldiers. They all had guns, you know, machine guns and guns. And so they're all in boots and hats and helmets and whatever. And I handed, he walked up, and they saluted him because Dr. Hammer knew Lenin. He had dealt with Lenin right after the revolution. And that Trotsky, he knew all these people, and he was very close to them. And they got to me, and I handed him my ticket, and the guns came out. And they're pointing guns at me in Red Square. And I said, oh, my God, I'm going to be a dead Jew in Red Square. So anyway... I yelled, Armin, Armin. He was already walking into the funeral. And he came back, started talking to them in Russian, and they let me go in. And I said, Armin, what was that about? What just happened? So I almost got killed. What just happened? And he said, I gave you my wife's ticket. And it said Florence Hammer on it. So they were a little confused. Anyway, we went in to the funeral, and they put us our seats, and this is all documented, it's in photographs. They put us in front of Lenin's tomb, and we were seated next to dignitaries that they thought were dignitaries, quote unquote, Yasser Arafat, Gaddafi, Fidel Castro, and various other world leaders, and none of which I was too comfortable being near. But anyway, we were seated there. The vice president and the secretary of state, one of your
our honoree at our upcoming April 29th dinner,
was seated in the back. And when the funeral, when the procession was over, you know, they had no religion at all in those days, and they goose-stepped in Red Square, and it was scary. It was just ugly and frightening, and they had rockets they were parading around, and they were burying Brezhnev.
Yeah.
And Andropov was taking over. Andropov was the head of the KGB. So it was a really strange time and a really frightening time for me. Anyway, the funeral's over, and we go into the for reception inside the Kremlin. We're standing there, and the vice president comes over to me, and he said to me, "How did you get that seat when they're hiding me in the back?" And I said, "I was with Armin. I don't care about the seat. I don't want to sit there." And as I'm saying that, a gentleman comes over, introduces himself, and says they want you and Dr. Hammer, not the vice president, they want you and Dr. Hammer to come down to the gravesite. They put Brezhnev in the wall of the Kremlin. And they wanted us to come down and say goodbye to him. And they had him in a glass encased grave, coffin, and you could see him underneath this glass. And we went down, and there were hundreds and hundreds of photographers. And all this was in Life magazine. And we walked together, Armin and I. And when Armin saw photographers, he had this huge smile on his face. He loved to smile when he saw a camera. And I said to him, they were just clicking, 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 clicking. And we were graveside. And John Bryson, a photographer for Life magazine, great photographer, got a shot of us. And I turned to Armin and I said, "Armin, you're smiling. And this man is dead. And he's been a friend of yours for 50 years.
This is inappropriate.
You're not supposed to be smiling." And so he frowned. And they got a picture of him frowning. And in Life magazine, they put the two pictures on the page, and it said, one said, "Armin Hammer at Brezhnev's tomb, before Jerry Weintraub told me he was dead," and Armin Hammer, Brezhnev's tomb, after Jerry Weintraub told me. So that was pretty spectacular.
That is incredible. Let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Jerry Weintraub, legendary Hollywood producer and author of the memoir, "When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead." But please say a word about our vice president who was relegated to the back. And
well, he became...
How did you meet him?
I met him in Kennebunkport. When I first went there, many, 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 many years ago. And he was a friend of my wife's, and they had summered together. She had summered up there every year in Kennebunkport with her family. And her brother owned the Playhouse, the Kennebunkport Playhouse, which was the oldest playhouse in the United States, the oldest summer playhouse in the United States. And he was quite a character. But when I got to Kennebunkport, I went to the tennis club. This is in the book. I went to the tennis club to play tennis. And they wouldn't let me in. I signed my name, and it said Jerry Weintraub, and they said, what kind of a name is that? I said, what do you mean? I didn't understand them. They said, well, what religion? I said, Jewish. And he said, well, we're restricted here. We don't have Jews here. And I said, well, what do you mean? I didn't get it, you know. And I left, went back to the house. I had just bought a house. And I said to Jane, my wife, I said, Jane, we have to sell this house or at least give it to a Jewish home for the aged or something. Because this is crazy. I said, I can't play tennis here. I'm not going to live here. They don't want me. She said, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. I grew up here. I know everybody in this town. That's nuts. It's crazy. I said, well, that's what they told me. So she said, it can't be. It can't be. Wait till tomorrow. That evening, I got a call from George Bush. And George Bush at that time was not in politics. He was in the oil business oil. In Midland, Texas. He had owned a company called Zapata Oil. And he said to me, would you like to play tennis in the morning with my father, who was then a senator, Prescott Bush, and Connecticut, and my brother and myself will play doubles? And I said, I'd love to, but there's a little problem. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. Would you like to play? I said, yes. And I met him for tennis the next morning at 9 o'clock. By 10:15, I was a member of the club. And then he made me a member of the yacht club, even though I didn't have a boat. And then he made me a member of the golf club. And we became great, great friends. And I was with him all through his political life and career, in every job that he had, and helped him on his campaigns and so on. But we became very, very, very close, and are still to this day very close. I got a very cute email from him yesterday. He wanted, he was trying to give his best wishes to a movie star who was having a problem with her husband. Guess who?
I think we might know.
Which I did. I gave him the email address, and I'm sure he emailed her and told her how much he liked her in Blindsight. That's who.
Yeah.
And anyway, to make a long story short, he by befriending me, opened the world to me and introduced me to everybody. And I had total access at the White House. I slept in the Lincoln bedroom many, 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 many times, right there with Lincoln. I think he's still in there. And the Queen's bedroom. And I had access to everybody in the White House and to the cabinet and so on. And there was nothing he wouldn't do for me. He did things for me that never could have happened in my whole lifetime, or 100 lifetimes, or it happens to one or two people probably through life, because I didn't work for him. And because I didn't go to work for him, not that I couldn't have, I could have gone into any position I wanted, but I wanted to keep our relationship, and I think he did too, this friend's relationship, because I could talk to him. I wasn't working for him. I called him Mr. President the whole time he was president of the United States. I could, and he kept telling, call me George, because we lived, you know, I lived up in the second floor with him. And I said, I can't. I just couldn't. The weekend he got out of office and we went to Augusta to play golf, I called him George for the first time in years and years and years and years. But he's a great man. He's a great, great man.
One of our guests today has raised the question, do you ever discuss politics with him?
All the time.
All the time.
Sure. But, you know, my politics are very simple. I'm not afraid of, I don't say what party I am and who I voted for, because that's a right that I don't have to expose that. But I'm a liberal, very liberal on social issues, all social issues. All social issues now, because I'm questioning the death sentence because of DNA, and I, you know, that was my last holdout. But I'm a conservative fiscally. So I'm in the center. Mm-hmm. I don't like the left and I don't like the right. Mm-hmm. I like the middle. That's what I like.
It sounds like you may convert to Buddhism, where the middle path is.
No, wait a minute.
Okay.
Is that a reference to Tiger Woods? Or?
No, no. Not at all. Not at all. Okay. People have so many wonderful questions. Have you ever found it difficult being a somewhat more... this person is referencing your association with various... more conservative political leaders and wonders if that's difficult when you work in a rather liberal place such as Hollywood. But have you been that close to others, or is it mainly George Bush?
The first time I'm close to both sides.
That's politically safe.
Like you having Willie Brown over at the Commonwealth Club, he's an old dear friend of mine. I'm close to both sides. I vote for the man or the person, and the staff that works around them. None of them are perfect, and I think the staffs are really what's important. I think you have to look at that. Mm-hmm. I don't find it difficult. I found it difficult for the first time the other day when I was interviewed by Bill O'Reilly. That was difficult for me. Other than that, because all he wanted to talk about was liberal Hollywood and liberal this, and whether actors should have opinions or not. I don't think he thinks they should have opinions, but I think he thinks he's the only one that should have an opinion. But I don't know that.
It makes life easier.
Yeah.
Someone wants you to tell us a great George Clooney story.
Okay.
I bet Jerry has lots of them.
I have many great George Clooney stories. George Clooney, in fact, I'm going to give you a George Clooney, Brad Pitt story so we can put them together.
Perfect. You know, this is Ocean's characters.
They love to, and my friends. They're like my children.
And your friends. If any of you saw the Vanity Fair issue, which featured Jerry at the party, and we'll get into his philanthropic and concierge work later, but where he received the UNICEF Humanitarian Award, you will see all of the boys there, almost like a little chorus of support.
Club. It's our club.
Yeah, very
it's
cute.
Ocean's Club, you know. Yeah. We have an Ocean's Club, and I have the card in my pocket. And if we were on television, I'd take it out and just hold it up to the camera. But the Ocean's Club card is a very important card. It's like you have to be a lifetime member. And there are very few. And
Bernard was in Rome. Might he get one?
No.
No.
No, no, no. No, but Bernard's in a better club. Okay. He's in my friend club.
Okay.
Best friend club. The Ocean's Club card, which all the guys have and the ladies have, when we go out to dinner, which we do quite often, and when we order wonderful wine, which can be thousands of dollars a bottle, and this and that, and we have these great times together and fun together. Whoever doesn't have their card in their wallet pays the check.
Oh, dear.
So it pays to keep the card. The last one who got stuck was Matt Damon, and he got stuck really badly. And I had the dinner with him again the other night, and before we ordered... We were in New York at Cipriani. Before we ordered, he took out his card, put it on the table. I have it tonight. I have it tonight. But anyway, to get back to Mr. Clooney and Mr. Pitt, and you know, Barbara Bush has always accused me, who is a great lady, and I hope she feels better. She's not well. She hasn't been well. She's always accused me of name-dropping when I start these conversations. Mm-hmm. But then she says... But the problem is, and she said this publicly, the problem is he really does know all these people.
That's true.
Anyway, Clooney and Pitt and I were flying back from, and Susie, we were flying back, I think, from Italy, Italy. And we had been filming. Bernard was not on that plane trip either. And... We got on the plane, and I'm known to drink a few vodkas every evening, maybe more than a few. And Brad said to me, or George said to me, let's have a little contest here, see who can drink more. And I said, let's go for it, get it out, you know, because I know I can drink both of those guys under the table. I was taught by Sinatra. So I said, get the vodka out. So they got the vodka out, and we started pouring vodka, and I started drinking, and I'm drinking, and I'm drinking, and one, two, and the bottle's gone, and they bring out another bottle, and we get into that one, and they're drinking right along with me, and now I'm starting to get a little woozy, you know, we're someplace over the ocean, and I'm looking at it, and I'm seeing two Brad Pitts and two George Clooney, and I'm saying to myself, they must, what's going on here? And boom, I pass out on the couch, and I wake up in Los Angeles. And when I wake up, I put my shoes on, and I stand up, and I feel funny. That my shoes feel very funny, and my socks feel funny, and my underwear feels funny, and my blood. They put M&Ms all in, through my body, in my underwear, in my socks, in my shoes, and they all melted. And I had all this chocolate coming out of me. That's what Clooney likes to do. Clooney loves games, gags. When we were shooting Oceans in Vegas, we all stayed at the Bellagio Hotel in these wonderful villas. And we had them all, and when they were very beautiful. And one evening, Clooney and Damon were in one of their rooms watching TV, and they all do imitations of me. And they do them, I'm told, I don't know what I
are
sound
like. Are they very
like.
Good? Have you seen
well,
the
I'm
imitations?
Told, I'm, yeah, I'm told that they sound more like me than I do. So anyway, they ordered a breakfast. We were shooting nights, which means you get to sleep about 5:30 in the morning, and or 4 in the morning, depending on what time you quit. We were shooting nights, and they called in and ordered breakfast for I don't know how many. It's in the book. It may have been 30. I say 30. George says 4. And I went to sleep, and I got up in a startled, the bell started to ring in the room, and in came room service, and it looked like breakfast for 400 to me. Bacon and eggs, and I put the light on, and all my sleeping pills went flying, and my Excedrin went flying, and I got out of bed, and I said, what is this? What is going on here? And they said, Mr. Weintraub, you ordered breakfast for 5:30. I had been asleep for 20 minutes. I said, I ordered breakfast for 5:30. I did not order breakfast. You did. You were in Mr. Damon's room last night. And you. I said, I was not. Who told you this? And I said, where's the person that... And they so they gave me... they said, the lady that took the order is not here. I said, well, get her on the phone. Where is she? So I got her on the telephone. And I said, I didn't order breakfast. She said, Mr. Weintraub, you were in Mr. Damon's room with Mr. Clooney, and you ordered breakfast. That's
so
what they
then.
Do. That's what they do.
That's incredible, just incredible. Moving away from the oceans, people,
okay.
And looking at another manifestation of incredible chutzpah, courage, maybe an ounce of insanity, but
more than an ounce.
Just share the business of how you talked to Colonel Tom Parker and said that you would arrange a show for Elvis. One, how you got the interaction with Elvis going, and then what you did since Elvis Presley could only perform to a packed house. The two parts of it.
Okay.
The deal with Parker and the show.
I had a dream when I was about 25 years old that I was going to produce and promote Elvis Presley. And I wrote it down on a piece of paper at 3 o'clock in the morning, showed it to my wife. And she looked at me and said, you know, you're a crazy person. why don't you go to sleep? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, and I get up very early anyway. I get up at 4, 4:30. I'm in the gym. And I said, no, no, I'm going to do this. She said, you're crazy. And the next morning, I called Colonel Tom Parker. I got him on the phone, and he was great. He just was wonderful. And he said to me, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, not going to happen, never going to happen. And I said, yes, it is. No, it isn't. And for the next 364 days, I made that phone call every morning. That was my first call of the day, because I don't hear the word no. I just hear the word yes. When people say no, it's an opportunity for me to get them to say yes. That's the way I look at it.
Or you think they really mean yes.
Yes. So the 365th day, he called me, and he said, do you still want Elvis Presley? I said, yes, I do, very much so. He said, all right. He said, you meet me tomorrow at 11 o'clock at the International Hotel in Las Vegas. I'll be at the roulette table, and bring $1 million. I said, fine, no problem. Hung the phone up. Now, in those days, $1 million is still a lot of money. But
I
think
so.
In those days, $1 million to me was foreign. It made no sense. I only thought the Rockefellers had $1 million or Carnegie's had $1 million. Not Jerry Weintraub didn't have $1 million. But there were a lot of people around New York who were very, very interested in me and thought that I was going to do well and used to say to me, if you need $1 million, or not $1 million, but if you need some money for something, please give me a call. I'd like to be involved. I went to every one of those people. I got nothing. Not a
penny. They said not now.
Not a penny. I still got on a plane and went to Las Vegas, believing I would end up with this $1 million from someplace. When I got to Las Vegas, there was a phone call waiting for me from a businessman in Seattle, Washington, who owned radio stations, named Lester Smith. And he said to me, I'm interested in this. I understand you may have a contract with Elvis Presley. I own radio stations, and I play Elvis Presley, and it's interesting to me. He said, what do you need? I said, I need $1 million. He said, okay, I like the idea. Sounds like a good idea. So I said to him, okay, let's just do it. He said, well, we can't just do it. It's $1 million. You know, you have to send your lawyers to Seattle, let them meet with my lawyers. And I said, no, you don't understand. I have 3 hours to close this. I need it right now. So he said to me, well, what do I get for it? I said, oh, that's easy. I'll give you half of my concert business. He said, I get half of your concert business. I said, absolutely. He said, done. We have a deal. I'll wire you the money. And I made a hell of a deal because I didn't have a concert business. So
we won't even go into earlier parts of the book where he said he took shorthand and typed.
Right.
Sorry
exactly.
about that.
Exactly. So I sold him half of a business that didn't exist. And I had to go down and get this $1 million from the bank. I arrived at the Royal Bank of Las Vegas, or
the
Nevada.
Royal Bank.
The Royal Bank. And the Royal Bank was a little store, and it had a purple curtain and a gold crown. And in those days, I wore jeans and lizard boots and a lot of Indian turquoise jewelry. So I looked kind of strange, and I had long hair and sideburns and so on. And I looked like some nutcase, a hippie. And I walked in, and I said to this young lady, I have $1 million coming here. In the cashier's check or cash or however. And she looked at me like, "What? Who are you?" You know? Especially in Las Vegas, you know. And I said, I do, I have it. She said, well, have a seat. So I sat down. There was one teller, and I waited. And every hour I went up back to the desk, and I said, is my money here? Did my money arrive? No. Just sit there. I think they thought I was going to rob the bank, you know. Anyway, after a little bit longer, the door opened and the president of the bank came out. And I think he was 12 or 13 years old. And he said to me, Jerry Weintraub, please come in. I went into his office. He said, here's a check for $1 million made out to Elvis Presley. What are you going to do with Elvis Presley? I said, I'm going to take him on a tour. And he said to me, well, do you need an accountant? He was ready to give up his job as president of the bank and go with me. Anyway, I took the money to the colonel. I made the deal with him. He took me up to meet Elvis. And when we made the deal, it's a long story, but your listeners can buy the book to get the whole story. I'll get to a point of it. So I met Elvis, and Elvis was a lovely guy, really a nice person. He was not into all the stuff that he got into when he was older.
One person asked if you thought he was smart.
Yeah. I don't think he was book smart, but he was smart. Mm-hmm. I think he was street smart. I don't know how much education he had, and I don't know how much he read, but he was certainly smart about music, and he was certainly talented, and he certainly knew what to do with an audience and he knew how to handle himself on stage. He was smart. He was nice. He had a nice family. He was a nice Southern boy. He was a nice guy, and he called me sir. And the colonel said to him, Mr. Weintraub's going to be your promoter, and he's going to be your producer. He's going to produce everything we do. And Elvis said, that's very nice, sir. I really appreciate that. I said, well, is there anything you want to ask me, Elvis? And he said, yes. He said, I want to make sure two things. Number one, when I appear any place, every seat will be full. That's number one. Number two, the first 20 rows must go to my fans, not to any big shots, because my fans give me the energy to perform, and I need them. I need them there. I'm not the same when they're not there. So I said, okay, no problem. And I went down and put this tour together. I was such a neophyte and so naive about anything. I had no idea about anything. And I had this huge star who I knew was going to change my life. And it was a life-changing experience. And at a moment, it was the moment in your life when, boom, the heavens open up and, you know, you're going to just, it's all going to be right. And I put this tour together that started in Miami, Florida, and ended 3 weeks later in San Diego, California. Now, you got to be pretty stupid to do that since you're doing one-night stands and there's a lot of places in between Miami Beach, Florida, and San Diego, California. But I didn't think about that. And I started the tour on July the 4th in Miami. I don't know if you've ever been to Miami on July 4th, but it's quite humid and quite hot. And most of the Floridians that live there are smart enough to get out of town
to leave
July 4th weekend. But we sold the show out. And they called me and told me that the show was sold out. And was I interested in doing a matinee? And I said, well, I'll certainly talk to Elvis about that. And I went to see Elvis and I said, would you like to do a matinee? And he said to me, sure. Yeah, no problem. So I put the matinee on sale. I said, can we sell it out? Yes, sir, easy. There's so many, such demand. I said, great, because I have to sell it out. Okay, no problem. I got to Miami on the 3rd of July and walked into the box office, and there were 5,000 tickets left for the matinee show. And I said to the man behind the counter there, I said, what is going on here, this 5,000, these seats? He said, well, we didn't sell them. We just didn't sell them. I said, but you told me we were sold out. He said, I only told you what you wanted to hear.
Oh,
I said, oh, wonderful. My career is over. Anyway, I went outside. The colonel came with Elvis to do a sound check, and I went over to the colonel, and I said, Colonel, we have a big problem. He said, we have a problem? I said, yes. He said, what is it? I said, I have 5,000 seats left for the matinee. He said, we don't have a problem. You have a problem. We don't have a problem. So I went outside to get some air to try to figure this out. And the county jail, the Miami Beach jail, was next door to the convention center. And I went in and had a conversation with the warden. And I said, I need I need a bunch of you prisoners to work for me. And I hired all the prisoners that were in the jail to come into the Miami Beach Convention Center and take 5,000 seats out for the matinee. And I put them in the parking lot. Now, they had to unscrew them from the floor. And we put them in the parking lot. And when we finished the matinee, they put the 5,000 seats back. We had sold-out shows. And that evening, I went to see Elvis. And I said to him, how did you like the shows? He said, they were great, Jerry, they're great. He said, I prefer the nighttime shows. The audience is much more involved in the show. He said, I couldn't hear him very well.
There were only 5,000 more people.
5,000 more people.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Jerry Weintraub, truly legendary Hollywood producer and author of a wonderful memoir, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. I asked Jerry as we were walking into the room a few minutes ago what would happen if he had laryngitis, but you never do, right?
I have had laryngitis.
It must be very awkward.
Well, I keep talking. I don't want to be dead.
People have asked what film that you've been involved with, that you've produced, are you the fondest of? I suppose this question comes up a lot, and you have to say something like, my children, I cannot choose one over the other.
No, I don't say that.
Okay, good, good. We want a more animated
I don't
answer.
I have a favorite film. Nobody saw it. Nobody's ever seen it. I think three people went to see it. It was called 9/30/55, and I made it many, many, many years ago. Jim Bridges directed it for me, wonderful director who died, and we made a film about the day James Dean died, which was September 30th, 1955. And it was Thomas Hulce's first film. It was Quaid's first film, Dennis Quaid. We had a wonderful cast, as I had in Diner, all kids that did very, very well. And it's my favorite of all my films.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So people
not the most money, but now my favorite film is the one that makes the most money. That's really my favorite.
What would that be?
I don't know. The Karate Kid series has done extraordinarily well, and we have a new one coming out shortly, June 11th, which is Will Smith's son. And Will Smith actually took his son and went to Beijing and made the film in Beijing with Jackie Chan. And the film is marvelous. I didn't want to do it. And he insisted on, he came to me time after time after time.
Sort of like you with Colonel Parker.
Same thing. Exactly the same thing. And Will's very persuasive. And he came with his producing partners and they wanted to do this, and I kept telling him, look, this is an iconic film. It's an iconic character. The Japanese character was iconic. So was the kid. And the film is part of film history. Don't mess around with this. You shouldn't mess with this. But they wanted to do it, and I said to Will, this is your son. You're putting your son in a tough spot. It's very tough to follow this kind of thing. No, he can do it. He can handle it. Well, fact is that when I got the film, I saw dailies every day, and I was not well. I couldn't go to Beijing at the time, but I saw dailies every day. When the film was cut together and I looked at it the first time, I cried like a baby. It's just a great film, and it'll be a smash. You'll see it's going to...
What's the name of the film?
The Karate Kid.
The Karate Kid.
They wanted to call it The Kung Fu Kid.
Oh, see...
And you see, the Kung Fu, because in China, they do Kung Fu.
Yeah.
In Japan, they do karate.
Karate.
And I said to Will Smith and to Sony Pictures, who put the money up, I said, why would you take the Karate Kid and make him the Kung Fu Kid? It's like taking Pepsi Cola and making a Dookie Cola. You got to be nuts. It's a brand. Why would you do that? So they agreed.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. There are so many questions that people have, and I think many of our guests today are just going to have to purchase the book because there are just so many things about your very, very interesting life. I want you to have an opportunity to just comment briefly on what brought you to the UNICEF organization and to the special interest you've taken in children with preventable disease, which I think was the rationale for the humanitarian award from UNICEF, well, and the focus on Africa.
Yeah, we got George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Don Cheadle, and myself started a foundation a number of years ago called the Not On Our Watch Foundation. And we raise a great deal of money because of their celebrity and everything that we, you know, we get the, wherever we go, the press comes and so on and so forth. So we have a machine that can raise a lot of money, and we use it. We use it for good things. And I think the Humanitarian Award for UNICEF was because of all the money we've given UNICEF and what we've done with UNICEF. Because we don't, all the money we collect, we give to organizations that are on the ground in Darfur and Chad and Burma and the Haiti earthquake. When the Haiti earthquake happened, we sent millions of dollars there and so on. So I think it all came out of that. And I've been philanthropic my whole life, not for any reason except that I think other people need, and I have. And I was taught to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather be on the giving end than the receiving end in that situation. And there's so much need in the world for so many different things, as we all know. You know, anybody who is lucky enough to have the things that I have in life should give. And if you don't, I think you... I haven't seen one shroud with pockets in it. When I see one, then I'll...
That's a very good way of putting it. So what is going to be your next big project?
Liberace, Bonnie, starring...
Oh, this is very good. I kind of wanted to return to
Bonnie
that
Ocean.
To see if you
no,
would
I am
make a commitment on the air.
It is my next... Did I talk about it yet?
No,
no
we
I
want
am.
You
That's
to.
My next movie, and it's...
You mentioned it, but we want a little
it's
fuller
description.
The story
description. Of Liberace, and I'm very excited about it. He was a great friend of mine, a man I liked a lot. In fact, I adored him. And Michael Douglas is going to play him. And Matt Damon is the boyfriend. Scott Thurston. Steven Soderbergh is directing.
What fun.
And it's going to be great.
Who will play the part of George Liberace?
Probably Bonnie.
Oh, that's so good. Jerry, I like this. I like this. This could really work out.
That's Bonnie Osher for those of you out there who are just tuning in.
Yes, we've referred earlier to Bernard Osher, otherwise known as Barney. Do you have any advice for young people who want to go into filmmaking, who are in filmmaking classes right now? What do you think are some opportunities?
Well, I lecture at a lot of schools and a lot of film schools. And, you know, all I can say is this. It's a very difficult business. It's as difficult as it gets. And if you believe in something, if you come across a piece of material and you believe in it, don't listen to anybody. If they say no, it's no good, script's no good, the idea's no good, this is no good, that's no good, just keep going. Because they don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what's going to sell, what's not going to sell. And it is an art form. And if you believe in something and you keep at it, that's what I did, and you never hear the word no, and you're tenacious about it, you'll get it done. And I really believe that's, and not just in the film business, in every walk of life. I think if you just don't listen to other people, take their opinions. You know, people have opinions. You listen to those. But when you believe in something, go for it. Just go for it.
Great advice from the legendary producer and filmmaker Jerry Weintraub. We've come to the conclusion of our program. We have space for just one very, very quick question. And I'm raising this. It's from someone who is a film student. Who wanted to know what type of project would be an interesting challenge for you now. And I think you've just responded that Liberace will be your next project on which you're going to focus your myriad talents. But then he has a second question. I hope this is all right. I don't want to be inappropriate, but I think it's very sweet. Okay. This film student would like to know if it would be possible for him or her, I do not know, to take a photo with you afterwards.
Ooh, I think so, as long as it's not Bonnie Osher.
Okay, wonderful. We are most grateful to Jerry Weintraub, the author of a new memoir, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead, Useful Stories from a Persuasive Man. And I think you have seen evidence of this uncanny persuasion.
Thank you.
We also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the internet. Today's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, held in association with the San Francisco Film Society. We want to remind our audience in the room that Mr. Weintraub will sign copies of his books in the lobby at the conclusion of the program, and we'd appreciate your allowing him to get to the signing table as quickly as possible.
May I stop in the men's room?
All right, you may do that. But wait a minute, we just are now going to go back to the conclusion on air. I'm Mary Bitterman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.